Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck!
I only got one thing to say to you. Strike this mother out.
2-2. He got a perfect game. Everyone done by the king.
Hey, you! Are you right there, Apple?
Took away a game-tying home run for Manny Ramirez.
That's my thing, fellas.
We will see you tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting us this evening.
Well, Brody, here we are on Tuesday, November 26th, a little bit later than we usually record. We're coming to you guys at 11:30 at night. It ended up being a very good thing we did, because we get to start off the pod this week with some breaking news. That is right, Blake Snell, the pitcher, the two-time Cy Young winning pitcher, painter of corners, resenter of slapdick prospects, has signed a 5-year, $182 million contract with the reigning champion Los Angeles Dodgers. It has happened. His name is on the dotted line. He is heading to LA. Ain't it a thing?
I hate it. Not a fan.
Not a fan?
Not a fan.
Why is that?
So boring. Like, I mean, look, good for Blake Snell. He's been jonesing for the giant contract. He finally got it. I'm a player's guy, so go get your money. But I'm a Yankee fan, so I don't really have a leg to stand on with this. But it just feels like there should be not a team that signs everyone. But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different schools of thought here. Good for Blake Snell is right. I mean, after last season's turbulent, to say the least, free agency period for both him and Jordan Montgomery, the two left-handed pitchers that really got dicked around by their agent, Scott Boras, and ended up signing one-year deals right at the very start of the season, as opposed to getting the long-term deal they were projected to last year. Snell signed a one-year deal with the Giants. Had a very rough start to the year, pretty clearly because he wasn't ready. But, you know, Blake Snell has a track record of being that kind of pitcher who, you know, he doesn't start off very hot and you wonder what the hell's wrong with him. And then over the last 3 months of the season, he has a 1.5 ERA. It's just the kind of pitcher he is. That's the role that he plays. If a team knows how to utilize that, it's going to be the Dodgers. They'll only need about 115 innings out of him. That's probably all that they're going to get. I had predicted Blake Snell to the Orioles, just a team that very desperately needs to sign starting pitching this offseason. I can't quite remember who you predicted him to, Brody. Who was your pick for Snell?
I had him going to the Cubs.
To the Cubs, that's right.
I did say 5 for $150, so I was, you know, got the years right. But
you're in the ballpark, yeah.
In the ballpark.
Yeah, this is such an interesting signing. I mean, obviously it means that on paper, the Los Angeles Dodgers are going to be close to unbeatable. That was already the case coming into the offseason. You know, they won the World Series with only one of their ace pitchers healthy. They are far and away the most lethal roster in all of Major League Baseball. They will be for quite a long time. They are not done this offseason. They will continue to add more players, continue to get better, and it's going to be a long time before I predict them to lose a playoff series. So this team is going to be a tank for a very long time. I mean, we said that a little bit after our World Series recap. They have maybe the brightest future any team has ever had, and at least as far as I can remember in Major League Baseball. But, I mean, what do you look at when you see this lineup?
I look at the rotation, and I see a bunch of guys who are still injury-prone. That is not going anywhere just yet. You know, it's very easy to just say, like, big addition to the World Series reigning champion and just say, all right, well, easy to see that they can repeat because their weakness was pitching, and now you go and get Blake Snell like that. Yes. Very good addition. But you still have a relatively unproven commodity in Yamamoto as your assumed 1-2 at this point, I guess. Glasnow is injury prone. Shohei Ohtani, we'll see if he can keep this up as, you know, he enters, what, age 31 season next year. And coming off of Tommy John, I'm sure he'll be fine. But how long can he do both? You know, we'll see. And if Ohtani is as reliable as he's been prior to his Tommy John, I guess, you know, your 1-2-3-4 is terrifying with Snell, Yamamoto, Glasnow, Ohtani, if they all live up to their potential and what we've seen them do. But baseball's a weird game. Things are not always as predictable as they may seem. So that's the only glimmer of hope if you're not a Dodger fan, I guess. It's maybe things end up going wrong for them because there's no reason that this team should not win the next two or three World Series in a row.
You absolutely said it. I mean, looking at that rotation, if everybody stays healthy, which is a massive if, it is difficult to see any lineup being able to hit one of those guys, let alone all of them, and especially over like a 5 or 7 game playoff series. I mean, the task seems next to impossible, but that is what baseball is. It's been a very long and storied history of guys doing things that, you know, in some cases seemed like they could have been impossible. So it's very easy to look at the Dodgers roster if you're a fan of any of the other 29 teams and think, well, shit, the rest of the league is doomed until 2030. But I think it's going to be imperative to not do that. Ultimately, there's going to be a lot of positives as well when it comes to watching the Dodgers, you know, and like having that as one of the 30 teams across Major League Baseball be this like big market Goliath that, I mean, could win 110 games every year. At one level, it forces like the big market teams or the competitors to try and match what they have. But seeing baseball as a spectacle, as a fan, just a neutral observer, if that's the perspective you want to take, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch the Los Angeles Dodgers. Like, I'm going to be tuning into a lot of their games on MLB TV next year, you know, even if that is what you want to think of as a hate watch. You know, like, I don't particularly hate the Dodgers. I hate some of their irrelevant ass utility men and relief pitchers who were calling the Yankees trash after the World Series, but that's a different subject. The Dodgers have like so many of the best players in baseball, and you know, those were not the guys saying that. You know, I have no beef with Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, a little bit of beef with Freddie Freeman after the World Series, but that's just a personal beef. That's a little bit of copium on my end. But you know, no beef with Tyler Glasnow. No beef really with Blake Snell, other than the fact that he's just not a fun pitcher to watch. Like, you go, he's going to nibble those corners for all 5 of his innings and 92 of his pitches. That is Blake Snell for you, but a lot of those starts are going to be with 1 earned run and 12 strikeouts. It's just the Blake Snell experience, and the Dodgers are signed up for that for the next 5 years, and what a 5 years it's going to be.
You also have Gavin Stone, River Ryan, Emmett Sheehan that were down last year with Tommy John. Or actually, Gavin Stone, I think, had a shoulder. I don't think he had Tommy John. But a couple of young guys who will probably be back either next year or very soon after the... Very soon. They'll be back soon enough where they have supplemental young starting pitching to replace any older starting pitching, like a Tony Gonsolin who was starting games with them last year. They're just set up for like a long time. And I think the worst thing that's happening to them right now is that Gavin Lux was not an effective infielder, and they're going to have to figure out a way to replace him. And now their rotation is solved, hypothetically, at least you'd imagine, they're probably going to focus on that. And I wouldn't be surprised if your other prediction last week of Willy Adames heading out there comes true as well, because I guess they just don't have a spending limit. And my only problem with the way that they are spending, and I do have a problem with it, and again, I do want to stress that I'm more pro-player, obviously, than pro-owner here. Like, you know, players should be getting paid, basically, is all I'm saying. Like, it's the fact that they kind of cheated with Ohtani and got away with this ridiculous contract of giving him nothing for 10 years. It just doesn't feel fair. It feels like they're not playing with the same rules that everyone else is playing with. And I'm sure that any other team would have been able to get away with this, but I don't imagine that the Reds will be offering somebody $400 million, but $10 million over the next 10 years, and then, you know, what did I say, like $390 over the second 10, so that they could pay them nothing and then go out and sign, like, Juan Soto, let's say. Like, it just doesn't feel like that's what's going to happen, and it feels like the Dodgers are the only team that can do that, and now they have, like, the best baseball player in history on their team, and they can supplement him with multiple $100 million contracts. This is not affecting them right now. Like, if they end up paying for this dearly, like in the 2030s, and they win like 40 games a year because they can't afford to do anything because they're completely hamstrung with cash, I guess then that's okay. Like, you know, because there should be some repercussion to this. But otherwise, it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, first of all, I do think that the Reds should hand out one of those contracts. I think Bob Castellini should say, hey, Ellie De La Cruz, take 10% of my produce conglomerate and be a Cincinnati Red for life. I'd like to see
I'm
something
fully
like
on board
that.
For that. He should be. It'll be sad the day that Ellie ends up on the Yankees, but I won't be too upset.
You make a good point. I mean, it does feel like this huge deferred contract system that the Dodgers have been signing all of their free agents with. It does feel like it's something that's exclusive to just that one team, and that the other teams are not able to do so, or not, I guess, are not interested in doing so for some reason. But that's going to be something that I'm going to be eyeing very closely over the next 2.5 years until the end of the current CBA, because you do get the sense that that's going to be one of the main things that comes up the next time that, you know, these guys have to go back to the table and negotiate a framework for how the sport is going to work. You think one of the very first things on that docket is going to be, well, how about this $700 million contract that the best player ever signed, and which he won't be seeing 90% of the money until 2034 or whenever it is.
Also no other players who bring in the endorsements that Ohtani does. So, like, you know, at the same time, it's a special contract because he's a special case, but it still just doesn't feel like it's something that's going to be allowed to be recreated with somebody else. Like, it's, I don't think there's a player that would accept it because of the fact that Ohtani is making more money probably off the field in supplemental income, but, like, it still just doesn't feel fair that he's able to do that and they can surround him with guys like this constantly and just bring in more. And also, don't forget, I completely forgot about this. Sasaki is probably going to end up there too.
I was going to mention that.
You know, like, it's, we have to be prepared for the fact that their rotation is probably going to be Snell, Yamamoto, Glasnow, Ohtani, Sasaki. And again, with some other names that I mentioned that are hurt, that are coming back. Like, there are...
That is a Diamond Dynasty-ass rotation.
Completely. Don't forget, your 1-2-3-4 in the lineup is Ohtani, Betts, Freeman, and Will Smith. Like,
oh,
I mean...
brother.
Granted, the bottom half of the lineup is not good, but, like...
It'll be good.
Because they might end up with Adames, too, as I just mentioned, because they don't have to pay Sasaki anything, and they could probably go pay Adames, like, what did I say?
Something like 140.
I said 108 over 6, which I feel like that's probably fair. You said 120 over 5 to the Dodgers. I said him going to the Braves, yeah. So I just wouldn't be shocked. Maybe they go get Bregman, too. Who knows? It feels like there's no end to what they're capable of. A little scary.
It's going to be interesting to see if any other teams are able to or even attempt to pull off like a deferred money type deal like the Dodgers have been doing with their guys, or if we go into the next negotiation having that be like a single team issue, because that could lead to potentially interesting and hairy discussion.
Wouldn't be surprised if a team is offering it to Soto right now, to be honest. So,
I bet they are. I bet the Dodgers are offering it to Soto right now.
Probably. Although, how much are they going to be able to pay out deferred when that is, you know, how is this going to work? Like, are the second 10 years in their luxury tag? Like, whatever. I don't know.
That's a problem for the next owner, I suppose.
I guess.
It's going to be very, very hard to beat the Los Angeles Dodgers over the next 5 to 10 years. We could be witnessing the birth of one of baseball's all-time dynasties, but life goes on. The sport goes on. We will continue talking about whatever happens down the road, because this is Mudville, and I am one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I am your other host, Brody Staub.
And it's funny, Brody, I was prepared to come in and have a nice, relaxed discussion about the two modest moves that had happened prior to about 1 hour ago at the time of recording. It was going to be just a relaxed, easygoing talk about a nice Jonathan India trade and a Yusei Kikuchi signing. But like they tend to do, the Dodgers had to go and fuck it all up. So a bit of an audible tonight for the Mudville podcast, but we're happy to do it. It's why we're here. And I'm happy that things finally seem to be heating up, because the stove had been quite cold for some time.
And the last few off seasons, it feels like the stove has been cold like well into December. So it's nice to see some stuff moving.
Let me be the first to say, from us to you guys and to your family, happy Thanksgiving. This episode will go up the day after, so we hope you guys had nice big dinners full of beautiful turkey, and we hope you fell asleep watching a terrible Giants-Cowboys football game at 4:30.
Cooper Rush and Tommy DeVito.
Cooper Rush and Tommy DeVito, baby. Speaking of Tommy DeVito, I rewatched Goodfellas the other night. What a movie.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Hot take, right? anyway. We got a little bit to talk about today. We got that Jonathan India, Brady Singer trade. We got Yusei Kikuchi to the Angels. And we are going to talk about Sean Baker's Red Rocket today. I'm very excited to get into that film. But before we do so, Brody, how have you been handling these few weeks without a lot of big baseball news?
I think I'm handling it okay. Getting by. The Kikuchi news is really funny because if you recall, another throwback to last week, I had Jack Flaherty signing a $200-something million contract with the Angels because it just felt like they were going to go out and just do that because that is kind of on brand for them. And I wasn't exactly right, but I wasn't exactly wrong. 60 mil to Kikuchi is pretty interesting. They also did sign Kyle Hendricks, which is funny. So he's 34. The Angels are doing Angel things, just going out and signing whoever, and we'll see how it works out for him, I suppose. The Jonathan India trade, I've been thinking that he was going to get moved for a while. You know, everybody, like, he's a trade conversation every single year for the last, like, 2-3 years. I'm a little surprised it's the Royals, to be honest, but I do like the move. I think he's a good bat for them to stick in the middle of their lineup. He has a little bit of pop. He can give you some on base. Like, he's just lengthens that lineup just enough to get into the bottom half that isn't too great and hopefully get you back around to the top. So I don't hate it. And if you remember last year, the Royals were extremely active in free agency. I don't expect they'll be as active this year, but I wouldn't be shocked to see them go add something. I do still think that they're going to end up with Jerks and Profar. I feel like that would be a very good supplemental addition for them to throw out there in left field, get an MJ Melendez out of there who really doesn't offer you too much. It's been interesting. I'm excited for stuff to keep on heating up. GM meetings are coming up, or winter meetings, I'm sorry. All fun stuff, you know. I'm enjoying. We got to actually watch a movie. That was fun. We saw Conclave. We talked about that, but then we watched this movie, Red Rocket, which I'm also very excited to talk about.
Hell yeah, man. You know that meme where it's like the guy in the suit telling a woman in the cubicle, hey, you're beautiful, and she's like, oh, thank you. And then it's like a really ugly guy in a sweater saying, hey, you're beautiful, and she's like, HR, please, HR, or something like that. That's like totally what we're doing just collectively as baseball fans. Like when the Royals go out after winning like 67 games last year and they sign Seth Lugo, Michael Wacha, and Hunter Renfroe, and we're like, that's what we're talking about. That's what these organizations should be doing. That's what small market bad teams should be doing to get back into the field of competition. And then it worked. It worked to perfection. Seth Lugo was a Cy Young finalist. Royals had, by all accounts, an incredible season. And that was just truly one of the biggest wins for the philosophy of team building that I personally support. But when it's the Angels, when that really shitty team goes out and they sign a bunch of free agents who, by all accounts, are pretty good players, we're like, HR, please. We don't want that. You're gross. It's because Artie Moreno is a fat slob.
Well, I was going to say, one of these teams has actually, you know, a well-documented track record of success in general and seeming like a pretty good organization on the whole. And the other one killed one of their pitchers recently because he had a drug problem. They didn't want to do anything. So, like, you know, it's, sorry, that's not funny, but, like, it is just a good way to shine a light on what's wrong with that organization. One of the many things. It's never been that they don't spend money. It's a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, definitely the most extreme example of Angels mismanagement. And
it is
by far the saddest.
Yes, it is. It's the most unfortunate. And it's also an organization, and this is not to the same level of tragedy that is, but they have truly kind of robbed us of one of the potentially greatest players that we could have watched of having like a good career just because
they almost did it twice.
They almost did it twice and Ohtani left. But they have done that with Trout. He is truly just going to be wasted out there in Anaheim. And it's hard to say that he's going to be wasted. It's already happened. It's over. Like, I mean, that's, I think we're, like,
I think we're,
I mean,
there.
Last year he was good, you know, until he got hurt again, but he got hurt again. And I think it's kind of, this is it. Like, is there any glimmer of hope that Mike Trout can go out and win an MVP again?
It would have to be a miracle. Like, I don't know if you saw today with the Philadelphia 76ers.
Ohtani winning one as DH is helpful, because maybe it opens the door for that.
That's true. I mean, I don't know if you saw today what the Philadelphia 76ers said about Joel Embiid, but it was basically like, we knew at this time of the contract extension that the odds of us being able to keep him healthy were not high, but we felt comfortable anyway signing that contract and giving him Supermax money when, you know, we're seeing what that looks like, how that's going to play out right now in Philly, where he's already basically committed to never playing back-to-back for the rest of his career. He's missing games right now. He's out with an injury. The team is like 3-12. And yeah, it just looks like a catastrophic mistake that the team was like aware of. But I mean, I don't know. I feel like the way that they are talking about Joel Embiid's health and like the probability of him ever staying healthy again for a full season, because like that's a player who can easily go out and win an MVP. It's a player who did win an MVP. And Mike Trout has won like two or three of them. So I don't know. I feel the same way about his health, even though, you know, that's a completely different sport. But we've had the Angels conversation. We've had the Trout conversation.
The Sixers kind of are the Angels of the NBA. Like, almost. It's not a one-to-one. But
definitely not a one-to-one, but there are similarities. Yeah, I don't really know how I feel about the Yusei Kikuchi signing. I mean, it could be one of those like Chris Bryant type deals where a guy goes, gets his money, and then just vanishes, falls off the face of the fucking earth like we saw. I guess the only reason I say that is we've seen it happen a couple of times with the Angels already. Like the Albert Pujols contract, of course, was one of the worst in baseball history. And then they
signed. Would he hit 800 if he didn't go to the Angels?
I think maybe. Shit.
is that on the table?
I think that's on the table. And then they signed Anthony Rendon, who just basically fucking retired, you know?
Well, but he doesn't even like baseball.
No, he hates baseball. Like, he hates it.
He actually went to the right place.
Yeah, exactly. No, it worked out for him, but it definitely sets a horrible precedent, you know, for future free agent negotiations.
Absolutely.
Kikuchi, a guy, always has been so, like, up and down throughout his career. I mean, I remember being so hyped up about him when he first showed up in the league in Seattle. Like, I was in a fantasy baseball league with my friends, and, like, everybody was, like, very quietly, like, excited about trying to draft him, and we all kind of, like, had those moment of realization that we were all in on the same player, and that was pretty funny. But it just goes to show like how much hype there was for this guy who was not good really at all for the first few years after that. Even like it took him a long time to figure anything out. Like, he's always been a pitcher where he needs to be in a good situation with good coaching who knows how to effectively utilize his arsenal, kind of one of those like all or nothing type arms. So do I trust the Angels to get the most out of him and be able to get him into a situation where he can thrive?
Wait, before you answer your own question, can I guess what your answer is going to be?
You can guess.
Is it no?
Ding, 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 ding. You got it. It's no. I don't trust them do that one bit. But I do think at this point, Kikuchi has a track record of, you know, at least being able to hold his own. Like, at the very least, they're going to get a lot of innings out of him. Like, I don't really see him suffering any sort of, like, major injuries. You know, his fastball tops out at, like, 92, so he's not particularly a candidate for like elbow surgery like we see with some of these flamethrowers.
Blow him out.
So I think he'll have a lot of like quality starts for the Angels, but like I don't see him ever being on a team that wins more than 75 games while he's there.
Yeah, that's fair. Look, he's not like one of I would say he's what, the fourth or fifth best pitcher on the market this offseason? Like, is that fair?
I think maybe, like somewhere around maybe there. Like five or six.
Maybe five or six. So, like, you know, this is not, and, you know, they didn't give him ace money. They didn't give him, like, a $200 million contract. It was, what, 60 over 3 years? So, like, it's, I mean, $20 million a year is, that's not nothing. You know, that's, like, almost what Rodon is getting. But, like, it is, like, he's not the biggest name on the market. It's just, this is not, like, when you compare it to the Chris Bryant thing. Like, Chris Bryant coming off of, you know, his MVP year, the World Series, like, you know, big star in Chicago. Like, all those things when he went to Colorado, like, that was, like, him disappearing was kind of surprising. Kikuchi going to the Angels and just becoming irrelevant is really kind of just got like a, yeah, well, it's kind of how it goes.
It's definitely on the table.
Is this team competing with a rotation? Can you actually, you know what? You don't have Fangraphs up, right?
I think I do, actually.
Don't look. Okay. Do you think you could name the projected rotation of the Angels right now?
I think I could do a pretty decent job of it.
Try it.
Okay.
There's five pitchers. So
five
why don't
pitchers.
You try it?
Okay. I would say,
I'll give you Kikuchi is number one.
Okay, Kikuchi's number one. They traded Griffin Canning to the Braves, so he's not going to be on there.
I got canned.
For some reason, I'm starting with kind of a deep cut, but is Jack Kochanowicz on there anywhere? He's not. Okay. They probably the one that got replaced by Kikuchi. Tyler Anderson?
Tyler Anderson is listed at number 3.
Listed as number 3. Okay. Patrick Sandoval? Not on there. Okay. Oh, boy. This is a tough one. Angels rotation. There are definitely a few names, and I'm just going to be like, oh, shit, I should have gotten that.
I did say one earlier.
Oh, they signed Kyle Hendricks.
Yes. He's okay. Listed at number 4. So right now you have Kikuchi at 1, Tyler Anderson at 3, Hendricks at 4.
Caden Dana?
Nope.
Oh, he's going to be
a name that you should definitely know. I mean, you should probably know who both of these guys are, but 5 is like, if I think of Angels pitchers, I think of this guy.
This is definitely not who you're talking about, but Samuel Aldegari? Shit.
But that's very funny. but no, not him. Italian stallion.
I don't know. I'm kind of over this. Give me the other two.
Reed Detmers is your number 5.
Shit, of course.
That's the one I was talking about. And Jose Soriano is listed at number 2.
Soriano. I forgot about him. They have so many lefties, man.
Yes. Jose Soriano is a rule 5 guy, and he's the number 2 in their rotation.
He had a good season. Like, he's got good stuff, honestly. I know he does.
But yeah. It's not... It's the principle of the thing.
He wouldn't be a 2 on in any other rotation in the league, I don't think. He'd be like a 4 or 5.
He also if he's in the rotation at all last year. So like, you know, I don't know. Like this is it's just I only bring this up because this team is just not very good. Like, I mean, you go out and you get Travis d'Arnaud, you know, they brought in Kevin Newman. Like, okay. Like, Scott Kingery is on your bench. Like, he's been kicked around the league so many times. You did trade for Jorge Soler, as you mentioned. Like, that's not a bad addition for them. Like, that's fine. But I don't know. Like, do they have anything going on? No. Like, it's just no, you know, no reason for hope.
You said it, man. The Angels are doomed. I'm sick of talking about them. I think that's
the
all
only
I've
hope
got.
Actually is that the division is not that good. So, like,
the division is bad, but even then, I mean, you know, they really have.
You're not going to win it. So,
incredibly low floor and an incredibly low ceiling.
They finished with 63 wins to the A's 69 last year. They finished below the A's.
Jonathan India for Brady Singer. Well, actually, Jonathan India and Joey Weimer for Brady Singer is the official trade. What are our thoughts there? I mean, I think this is good.
I like it for the Reds more than I like it for the Royals.
Like it for the Reds? Okay. I mean, I don't know if I like it for either team, but I think it might make a little bit more sense in my eyes from the Royals' standpoint, just because they really did not have a leadoff hitter last year at all. Like, they just did not get any sort of production. And when you have Bobby Witt Jr. in your 2 slot there, you very much need a guy who can get on base. And Jonathan India can definitely get on base. You know, he's a guy that's got good plate discipline. I think he had like a 3.6 OBP last year. That would have been way better than anything that Kansas City had going. So I think that is what they were looking at when they saw Jonathan India available and thought, shit, let's go out and acquire him. I think the Reds, you know, like you said, they had been trying to trade Jonathan India for a while. I think their full intention was to do so last year. The injuries to Matt McClain and Christian Encarnacion Strand prevented them from doing so. They ended up needing Jonathan India's services for another year, but now that those guys are both healthy, Ellie is fully locked into the franchise shortstop role, and they've got Noel V. Marte up. Spencer Steer can play a little infield. I know he's usually in the outfield, but they're very deep in the infield. Kind of seemed like Jonathan India could be a logical trade candidate for quite a while now, and I'm not surprised to see it happen. Do I think maybe they could have gotten a little more than Brady Singer? Perhaps, but I'm sure they tried very, very hard and for a very long time. So the fact that they pulled the trigger on this deal now indicates to me that this was the best deal that either of these teams were going to get. I'm not sure how Brady Singer stuff is going to play in Great American Ballpark. I mean, it's kind of a bam box.
Tough place to pitch.
Singer's one of those like sinker slider guys, so I don't know. Maybe he's able to induce a bunch of ground balls to keep the ball in the park and keep his ERA down, but never been a guy with like ace or even two, maybe he could be a two in a rotation, but I think that's a stretch. Like, Singer for me is a guy like a 3-4 type, but definitely a pretty appealing guy in that slot in a rotation. You just don't want to give him the ball with the game on the line. I don't think I'd want to go to someone a little more dominant.
He is a starter, so you know, I don't think you need to worry about that too much. But he also, you know, he doesn't really walk a ton of guys, and he really is good at putting the ball on the ground, which for playing in Cincinnati, that's what you want to do. He does get a decent fly ball rate. Like, he's like a 30% guy, which I don't know. Like, you're not going to be seeing a ton of powerful teams in the NL Central. So it's not like, it's not the end of the world. It's not a terrible fit. The reason I like it a little bit more for the Reds than I like it for the Royals is just because the Reds, I didn't want them to give up on Jonathan India. Not give up on, I shouldn't say that, but to move away from Jonathan India, just because it feels like he fit there. He's synonymous in my head with the Reds, and that's just because he plays there. Like, maybe it's a little unfair for me to associate him there. But they have a really good roster right now with, like, you know, maybe not really good, but they have some young talent. That's like, they have an exciting roster. It's got a lot of potential. And Jonathan India has been there for a long time through some leaner years. So now that they're actually kind of turning into a time when they actually might be able to compete within that division, hopefully, you know, next year. It feels like he should have been around for that. But also, you know, they did need pitching. And Brady Singer, again, he'll fit in there pretty well. I don't know. They also have just some good pieces. Like, Matt McClain now can be your full-time second baseman. He's very exciting. Really good hitter. I'm excited to see what he can do. Ellie is going to be 23 next season, so he's just getting a little bit more mature, hopefully. Could give you, hopefully, something that's a little bit more consistent, less raw, as he's been, you know, in the last few years. And, I like TJ Friedl, too. I feel like he'll have a bit of a better season. Like, Spencer Steer, obviously, is awesome. Like, we'll do more during our preview in a few months. But this is, you know, I don't hate this Reds roster, and I feel like they could have really used another pitcher. So I think Singer's a good way to go.
Yeah, I'm looking at their rotation right now on FanGraphs, and they have it projecting to be Hunter Green, Brady Singer at the 2, Andrew Abbott at the 3, Nick Martinez, who had a very good end to the regular season this past year.
He's weird, too, because they like to use him out of the bullpen to start games, because he's good at coming out of the bullpen, but he can give you length. So he'll come out, like, in the second and then pitch 7 innings or something. So he's weird. But
any change-up dominant guy I always find to be a little bit weird. But fun fact, he was also the only player in the league who accepted the qualifying offer this year, which was probably a good call. I mean, yeah, the only one. I don't really expect him to get more than $21 million on the open market.
No.
So that was smart.
No, that feels like the top end of his
and
earning.
And then
potential.
They have Nick Lodolo at the 5, which probably the second most talented pitcher in that rotation. But
right.
Lodolo has always been kind of more of an idea than an actual pitcher. So 2025 is going to be big for that to change for him, or else I think you're going to start to see a lot of people start to get off the boat there for Nick Lodolo. But they've also got Rhett Lauder, who should have a rotation spot next year. Graham Ashcraft is kicking around. And then they drafted Chase Burns at number 2 this past July. So
that's right.
Some solid rotation
pitching
options
the
for the Reds moving forward. But looking at that, I think I started to like the trade a little bit more. I think the idea of their rotation in my head, I think, looked a bit more appealing than it actually does doing so in practice. So I guess I get this trade for both teams.
Who is it?
House cleaning. Hey, surprise. Hey.
Hey.
Lil?
Oh, my shit.
Oh, well, nice to see you, too. How you been? How you been?
Okay.
It's me, Mikey. Remember me?
I know. What are you doing here for?
Well, I just came to see Lexi. Well, I came to see you, of course, both you guys. But is Lexi here right now?
Lexi.
Thank you.
You won't believe who's here. Oh, my gosh. Oh, shit.
Surprise!
The whole NBA Cup is so stupid.
Yeah, I mean, I like it because it gets guys paid, and it seems like some people, you know, care about it, and they...
Who?
I don't know. I guess people say it adds a layer of competition. The only time I saw confirmation of that was when the Rockets scored an extra bucket in garbage time tonight to try to get the point differential for the seeding or whatever, which the Timberwolves fans booed them for. I'm not sure anybody's going out there and saying, I got to win this NBA Cup. Lived my whole life leading up to this moment where I can win the in-season tournament.
If it had been around for like maybe 50 years or something, like maybe I could get into it. I also, though, I don't know why it's now. Why isn't it in like January or February?
It does seem pretty
early.
Like
leading into the All-Star game.
Why don't they just replace the All-Star game with this? They're always talking about ways to get guys to care about the All-Star game. I don't give a shit about the All-Star game. Just replace it with this.
Problem solved. I mean, at least it's something. Like, then, you know, look, this is not... It's not ideal. Like, I enjoy the baseball All-Star game, but that's because they actually, like, you can't half-ass baseball. Like, you know, like, I mean, I guess you can, but it's like...
Anthony Rendon does.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's true. But, like, it's harder to half-ass baseball than it is to half-ass basketball. Like, you can literally half-ass it and that you don't play half the game. Like, you don't just don't play defense. I don't know. It's I think it's also easier to show off in baseball. Like, you know, you make a diving play you might normally not go for. You swing a little harder or something. Like, you're not going to put your body on the line to drive in the All-Star game or something. Like, you know, or, like, play really hard defense because you don't want to. Like, it's... At least people might care. Like, I've also thought about maybe like a 3-on-3, like March Madness thing where like every team sends three guys who are like all-star worthy or like their top three or something. And you just do like a weekend of March Madness stuff because they might care about that. I don't know. The NBA has some stuff to hammer out.
A 3-on-3 tournament, I think, would be sick. And I personally, I'm an Oklahoma City Thunder fan. I feel very confident that Thunder would win that in a walk. They would send Shea, J-Dub, and Chet and leave with the title 9 times out of 10.
Now, the Knicks sending Brunson Cat and maybe Josh Hart or Bridges or Ananobi.
Yeah.
Like, there's guys that you might want that could give him a run.
I mean, Wemby might be able to win that by himself one day.
That's a great point.
We're getting off topic here. We've got a movie for you guys this week. We are talking about Sean Baker's Red Rocket. Came out 3 years ago now in 2021. I think approaching the anniversary of its release. This past week was the first time that I revisited the movie since I saw it in theaters. And I'm happy to say that I think that it totally holds up. Brody, was this your first Sean Baker movie? What did you think of it?
Yes, sir. It was my first. It was very fun. It was really kind of not what I was expecting after the first 5 minutes. I read while I was watching the movie, I started reading a little bit more about production and stuff like that. And it was like his whole thing is trying to normalize like sex workers and stuff. And then I read that right before the conceit of the movie had started to reveal itself. And then it started to change a little bit more, get a little bit more hot and heavy. So I just wasn't really expecting it. But this movie was really entertaining. Let's say that. It was the performance from Simon Rex was fantastic. Susanna's son was really kind of, you know, she pops on screen, that's for sure. I was convinced that where it was going was that it was his daughter. The whole time. Like, and then I just kept on getting more and more concerned the whole time that it was going to be like something at the end where like the mother walks in, then he's going to have to hold like this whole, I was like, oh my God, is this what's going to happen? Because the first time she's introduced, they show her eyes really close up and they cut back to his eyes and they're like the same. And then she's like, I'm 17, about to be 18. And you've heard like 4 times that he left 17 years ago. And it's just like, I was convinced that that was where that was going. And,
you know, Brody, I never had that thought once, but it's not a bad theory. I can see why you came to it, honestly.
Yeah, I was convinced that that was what was going to happen. And I was like, oh my God, this is getting terrible. And then it just, I was very happy that it didn't because it was not
that would have been a little bit darker.
My next question for you.
Have you seen Old Boy?
No.
Okay. Got it. Anyway, Red Rocket, Sean Baker, super interesting director. I think I've gone back and forth a lot as to whether I would consider myself a Sean Baker fan, but now I think I'm decisively settling into yes. I think he's had an interesting recent career trajectory. The first movie that I was aware of his, I believe, was Tangerine, which, you know, you talk about his prerogative being to normalize sex work. I think that's probably the most crucial example of that in his filmography. It's a movie about transgender strippers in Los Angeles. And I know that's not a great description of it, but I saw it once like 6 years ago, so forgive me. The Florida Project was the first like major release that I remember anticipating from him. That was a movie that, when I saw it, that really blew me away, because that came out in late 2017, which was still around the time that I was starting to pay close attention to newer directors and the release of new films into theaters. It was a very crucial time for me as a moviegoer, and as well as, you know, one of the biggest landmarks within Sean Baker's career. That's a movie that takes place in a motel in Florida, where this woman is trying to take care of her young daughter. And I felt like it really captured the essence of a very specific place in the world, one that I will admit I have not been to, so I am kind of making assumptions here. It didn't seem like Hollywood actors on a set trying to emulate feelings they've never felt. And I very much feel the same way about Red Rocket. I think what the Florida Project did for rural Florida, Red Rocket does for this small town in Texas that Mikey Saber wreaks havoc upon. But yeah, the Florida Project features a jaw-dropping performance from 9-year-old Brooklyn Prince. Such an impressive performance from a little kid. She's the best part of a movie that features Willem Dafoe at his best, honestly, and that is really all that I need to say. I mean, I think if you have not seen Florida Project yet, I can't recommend that enough. I remember that being a movie that my dad really, really loved. That just sort of came to me as a memory of him being very impressed by it as well. Sean Baker made a couple of very good impressions on me in his career, you know, and then this movie was 4 years later. And then Anora this year, I mean, this is sort of his most mainstream movie yet. A couple of the scenes toward the end of Red Rocket sort of serve as an appetizer for the movie that he just released a couple months ago. And I will get into why, but I really enjoy Red Rocket quite a bit. I think it's probably Sean Baker's strongest film. Mikey Saber is the only protagonist of his that I am aware of who is just objectively a huge piece of shit. And that really is a lot of fun to watch. So I think this is a fantastic addition into the long cinematic canon of a guy showing up to town and just immediately throwing everyone's lives into disarray. That is one of my favorite conceits for any sort of movie. So I really like this one a lot. Do you have anything else to say before we sort of get into the plot?
Nora, I saw the trailer for before something, and I did not know anything about Sean Baker at the time. I've never seen the Florida Project, but just like as I watched the trailer for that, it revealed like a good bit about the plot. It was really well done, and it was definitely very intriguing because it felt like a type of storytelling that I'm definitely not used to seeing too often, and this movie absolutely kind of confirmed that. Just because it is, I mean, you put it best. It doesn't feel Hollywood. You know, it's funny because Simon Rex is like, you know, some old MTV VJ or something. So like, you know, he's been around for a while. But everybody else in this movie, I think June, the daughter of, you know, his drug dealer, Leandria, the mother who's, you know, buying from to sell. June, the daughter, is apparently just a local of Texas City where they shot this, and they saw her walking down the street and liked her look, so they asked her to audition. So in some cases, literally, they're not Hollywood actors. They are just locals in the area. There's also, just reading about the Florida Project, like using Disney as a backdrop for like all of this terrible, you know, reality that is directly around it. This movie does something very similar, but in the complete opposite direction, with every single shot having this like belching, disgusting looking oil refinery in the background, just spitting smoke. You just kind of feel like there's this one scene where he drinks like some tap water, and like my grandfather's town in upstate New York, they had a steel plant that was around them, and like there's a cancer cluster that's like in the town, in like the area that was around it. There's theories that it's related to contamination from the steel plant getting into the groundwater. And like, that's, it just feels like something that's, it's not like a threat, but like them like smoking all the time. It just looks so unhealthy, but it's not even like a thought. It just has this like specter of just danger and like this unacknowledged maliciousness that's there, that's just like kind of lurking. And then Mikey being like this guy who's just using everybody to his own end and destroying everything in his wake is like a good fit for the town.
The last thing that I'll add about Sean Baker, just as a guy before we get into the plot of the movie here, there's a very sort of strange and online controversy earlier in the year, back when Twitter likes were public. A lot of Sean Baker's were troubling. I mean, he had liked a number of tweets from like Tulsi Gabbard or from some of these whack job politicians, you know, some things very negative about the campus protesters in support of Palestine earlier in the year. Sean Baker had sort of had a long history of doing stuff like that, but it was like really only known to like very online, like film Twitter type people. So the fact that that sort of raised a bit of a brouhaha earlier in the year, like it kind of called into question like the ethics of condemning somebody for something that they didn't necessarily say, or like didn't, you know, issue public statements in support or against, you know, any particular thing, as well as just like the sort of general feeling of embarrassment of even like knowing that that exists and is a controversy. I don't know, does that say more about me than it does about him? Because should directors right. have a very long history of having inexplicable politics while still making some of the most like culturally relevant movies that have ever been made in some cases. I mean, the prime example that I think of is It's a Wonderful Life, which, you know, I consider to be the most effective piece of like left-wing propaganda ever made, really. Like, it's a movie That's about how this capitalist is going to make life worse for the whole town, and how this like do-good man who wants to help the rest of the community like saves everybody just by being born and by showing up and like doing the work or whatever. And it's directed by this guy who's just, yeah, you could go to his Wikipedia, Frank Capra, lifelong Republican, stars Jimmy Stewart, lifelong Republican, became more conservative towards the end of his life even. So, I mean, I don't know.
I think it just kind of goes to show that nobody actually listens to any single thing that a movie has ever said. It's like, yeah. Nobody gets it. The Punisher is like every cop's favorite thing. It's like, you don't even know what this is. You don't know what you're even watching. You don't know what this is about.
Do we separate the art from the artist? Is it even worth doing that?
Like, Punisher.
Is this an artist that even requires being separated from the art? Like, I don't think so. I think people have a right to be mad that the director of a bunch of their favorite movies is out there supporting these terrible people with these really harmful ideas. But like, at the same time, you know, I don't want him to stop making movies. I think he's really quite good at it. And
it's a funny way to put it at the end of that. But yeah, it's fair.
So like, I don't know. Even worth mentioning? I don't know, but I wanted to. So
I think worth mentioning is, yeah. But it, like, it's just, you know, just something to think about. I mean, like, it's not like he's a terrible person himself. I don't know.
He seems like a really nice guy by all accounts.
Yeah. And like, his movies really kind of, you know, look at an interesting piece of this country that feels very misunderstood or misrepresented or just ignored. So I don't know. Like, it's hard to say, but like, I don't know. It's when you tell stories about people who don't get stories told very often, and that is kind of like where you focus, it makes sense that you might not have the most familiar ideas or something. Or, well, although it says he's from New Jersey. And he went to NYU, actually. So
yeah.
You know what? I take it back. I don't really know what's going on with him. So never mind.
I'm glad that you brought that up, though, because this movie, like, watching it for the second time, like, you know, we're not the first person to say that this movie has a lot to say about Trump, like, that this movie could be even seen as, like, an allegory for Trump, or, like, Mikey Saber himself as sort of, like, a Trump stand-in. I think that last one in particular is kind of a boring read of the movie. but it made me realize that I think
Trump is everywhere in this movie, though.
Exactly. I am much more interested, especially now that he's going to be back in office, and like his presence is sort of just like the air around us now. You know, it makes me realize that I'm much more interested.
It's the same thing
in
with the refineries in the town. This malevolent force that's impossible to ignore.
That's right. It makes me realize that I'm much more interested in Trump as a setting than as a character in whatever art is created about him or about his presidency or the world that he has contributed so much to creating over the past 10 years. You know, like I don't particularly want to see like his arrogance or his bravado like parodied or satirized, because like we've been doing that for a very, very long time. I'm interested in seeing what the lives are like of the people for whom, like, for them, you know, supporting him is just the thing that you do, because everybody that you know is a Trump supporter because they were told to be Republicans all their lives and they've never questioned it, and it's a cult of personality. I mean, it's what Republican politics are right now. But I think
that's also a little oversimplifying, just because he does speak to these people too. It's not, but like, you know, they also do believe in what he says for various reasons. So it's like, you know, there's a lot to get into with that. But I do like what you mean is, you know, using him as a setting, because the way that people respond to him is a really good way to just give you character quickly. I feel like that's going to be in the future, like just a good, if you're talking about the 70s and you have somebody who's like really clean cut with glasses or something, it's like, you know, kind of where they stand at the time.
That's a Nixon voter. Like a headband.
Yeah, exactly. Like somebody with like a headband and like a tie dye shirt, you know, it's like if they have like Trump shit on, it's like, okay, well, you know, you kind of get what the deal is. They're like, there's very, very drawn lines that kind of useful in a storytelling way, because you can clearly kind of tell you what, like, just the way kind of things are in that era, like what is thought about, what is like, what the worries are, where people are at mentally, you know, or just, there's a lot that you can do with class. Like there's a ton that you can dig into with like how he is received and how he's treated as an idea. And I feel like that'll be more interesting in the future compared to just your Alec Baldwin on SNL. And that's an old reference from like years ago, but you got the idea.
I think that that's something that this movie does so well, though, you know, because, you know, even though you have shots of like MAGA billboards or Donald
Half
Trump,
the billboard, they're on TV constantly. Yeah,
they're talking, there's like all the 2016 election is on TV constantly, right, in this movie as sort of a backdrop. For a movie that features all that and like makes such a point to be like, this is 2016, this is Trump country, none of the characters explicitly say anything political or really seem to care about politics like at all. Like they watch it because that's what entertainment is in America now, is politics. But that just sort of furthers for me the sentiment and the feeling that conservative politics down there is just like the air. Like they don't even really think about it or think about the fact that that's what they're supporting or they're backing, because that's just like the thing that you do.
That's how it is.
I think I'm more interested and more open to seeing directors try to like replicate that or to try to put that sort of sentiment on screen than I would have been like 8 years ago or so. And that's not to say that I want to go reading those stupid like Washington Post op-eds that they would run throughout 2016 and 2017 about like in the elite cities they want everybody to have healthcare and free education, but in this rural Ohio diner Mark isn't so sure. And it's like, no, I don't give a shit about that. I don't want to read anything like that. The fact that like right-wing politicians have so effectively turned so much of the country into an environment in which supporting them is just natural, I think that's something that as filmmakers, people are going to have to start grappling with that. Sean Baker does a very good job of that in this movie. This might even be the preeminent example that I would think of a director capturing Trump County without being obnoxious about it at all. And I think that that is a bigger achievement than we might let on.
I completely agree. It's just something that you notice as you watch. It doesn't hit you over the head, you know, it's not ham-fisted or whatever. And it like it doesn't even tell you what it thinks of that. Like it just presents it and it lets you come to your own conclusions about what it says about the town, the characters, the, you know, the setting, like the country, whatever. Like, doesn't even tell you what time period it is. Like, it reveals itself to be that, but you don't know the first time you see, you know, either Trump on TV or you see the billboard or whatever. You don't know if it's like post-election or whatever. And then it, you know, it tells you like over time, because they have a Hillary Clinton accepting the nomination that kind of gives it away mainly. It's interesting. It's definitely something that this era is going to reflect in films in the future. And it's not something that I think you think of while you're in the era of like what it's going to be like, you know, because I don't know, if you asked me, how would you make something and immediately show that you're in like 2018, I don't think I would immediately jump to politics. But it definitely is like now, like it feels like it's definitely going to be the best way to just kind of immediately show you what is going on. And again, like how different things are treated. Like when I drive around here in Westchester, there are houses that would be like a couple weeks ago, right before the election, there was one group of houses that I'm thinking about for a very long time. It was actually in Connecticut. There was this group of four houses that were all really close together. As I was driving along the street, each one had the opposite sign across from it. So like one house, like on the left, had a Kamala sign, house on the right that was even with it had a Trump sign. And then the house next to the Trump sign had a Kamala sign, and the house on the other side next to the Kamala sign had a Trump sign. So it was like, you know, it was just like this crisscrossing, like the lines were drawn, but it was right there. And I was like, these guys have no block parties. Like, you know, no one's coming over for coffee or whatever. It's an interesting way to put like a quick snapshot of the way that things are. And this film definitely treats it in an interesting way that it's just enough to make an assumption or come to a conclusion that without, you know, telling you what it thinks of it even. So interesting.
If I was making a movie and I wanted everyone to know that it was 2018, I would make all of the characters listen to Brockhampton.
I was thinking either that or Closer by the Chainsmokers, movie, something like that. Rockhampton's perfect.
Well, shit. What is this movie Red Rocket about? We have Simon Rex as Mikey Saber, a former real-life porn star playing a fictional one. He is opportunistic.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, no.
Serious?
Yeah, Simon Rex. You didn't know that? Yeah.
I did not know
Absolutely.
That.
He is opportunistic, he's manipulative, he is a proud, bold-faced liar, and he is the last person you should ever trust. But he's also charismatic, his smile is infectious, it's clear that he holds so much influence over the people in his life, only to the fact that he's able to appeal to people like Lonnie, who remembers him from an incident when Lexi was Lonnie's babysitter, and she snuck Mikey in when they were kids, and Mikey ended up running out the window naked. Because of that, Lonnie takes a liking to him years later. Mikey's the most interesting person he's talked to in a long time. Or because he's able to wear people down with his persistence. Like, within 10 minutes of the movie, Lexi and Lil go from telling Mikey to go fuck himself and threatening to call the cops for trespassing to almost immediately allowing him inside and letting him stay there for a month. We don't even know exactly what he did when they're yelling at him like this, but I think it's a testament to Sean Baker as a screenwriter that even though we're just meeting these characters, it feels at least emotionally like we know their whole backstory. Who are some of these characters who Mikey manipulates and lies to in his time in town? There's Lexi, his wife, who you'd very reasonably assume was an ex, but right away there's that exchange of, it'll be like we're still married. We are still married. That I think lands so well. I love that line delivery. Lexi was a porn star too, just like Mikey. Clearly, her days of acting in adult films are long behind her, and she's now trying to skate by, just like everyone else in the town. She's deeply resentful towards Mikey, who we can assume and infer from some of the stories Mikey tells that he was a huge influence on Lexi's life and the decisions that they made together, or possibly that he made for her, were one of the main reasons that she turned out the way she did. And in that sense, the parallels between Lexi and Rayleigh / Strawberry, the girl that we meet about halfway through the movie, are very chilling, but more on that soon. we find out that Mikey's reemergence in town actually is kind of a huge relief for Lexi and Lil, because it means Lexi doesn't have to sell her body on Craigslist for a few months. And while this is never made explicit, I infer from that realization in the movie that this is the reason they let Mikey back in at all, is so she wouldn't have to do that to herself anymore. But you find that out from Lil, Lexi's elderly mother who owns the house and ultimately makes the decisions within. She is the one who, like, you know, technically signs off on Mikey actually being able to stay there as the owner of the house. So it's a very interesting dynamic in this small Texas residence on this very dry and lifeless patch of land. And that is the existence that they have created for themselves, I suppose.
They kind of just feel like they grew out of this land. You know, he shows up and he kind of feels like he makes sense there, but then you meet them and everyone just feels like they're like a part of the landscape there, like they've been there for forever. It's just this part of Texas that, you know, like I don't know much about this area, but it is very believable that this is like the vibe of what the place feels like. And it's just, you know, you could just tell he feels like he's just such a piece of shit. Like, and he shows up and you can just tell he's bad news, and you just kind of want them to say no, actually have him go away, but you know he's not gonna.
But who else to mention? Lonnie, the bored ass neighbor, who I would imagine is around like 19 or 20. He admires Mikey and sees him as this cool, aspirational guy, largely because he has only seen him two or three times in his life and thinks of
Mikey's back in town.
Yeah, fucking Mikey. He thinks of Mikey as this like urban legend who has miraculously come back into their lives. And the most initiative I think we ever see Lonnie take in this movie is when he drives to the mall so he can pretend to be a veteran and beg for money in Stolen Valor, which is obviously like a massive like scumbag move. And I think, you know, either is intended, but will certainly have the impact on a lot of people watching the movie of like of being this like unforgivable act, just this reprehensible thing. I didn't really care quite as much. I just sort of felt bad for the guy that this is what he was reduced to, you know, just like that's a very pathetic existence. Was it insurance? I thought he was asking people for money.
No, I think he was there trying to get like VA insurance, which made me feel really upset for the guy. So like, well, it's, you know, either I think way, he's supposed to be in his late 20s or like, you know, mid 20s or whatever. He's someone without health insurance. So like that's, you know, somebody says that earlier on. And I think that's what was going on.
Yeah.
Could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that was what it was. So, yeah, it, just depressing.
Either way, he's young enough to the point where it was not a believable grift and it gets, you know, people tear it apart within about the 30 seconds. So
not well versed enough in the military to pull off any kind of lie. Presented to not be well versed enough in anything to lie about anything.
Exactly.
That's a fair way to put that.
Then really the only other characters around the neighborhood that you need to know are Leandria and June. You touched on it a little bit, Brody, but Mikey sells weed for them, goes back, gives them most of whatever he makes. Crucially, does not get a job his time in Texas. All of the money he makes is from selling weed to the hard hats in the donut store, which Leandria explicitly tells him not to do. So that becomes a point of contention. That is sort of the backdrop for the hijinks that ensue, is Mikey coming back into this house and his wife and her mother begrudgingly letting him in. And then he goes around on his bike when we get all of these shots of like oil refineries and dead grass and abandoned streets as he just goes from place to place. And eventually, critical scene in the movie, Mikey takes Lexi and Lil out for donuts on him as this huge thank you for letting him stay. they end up actually getting really excited that they can order whatever they want and get coffee with their donuts and have it be all on him. And it seems like it's the best thing that has happened to these people in months. And Mikey goes to pay and it all costs $6. Which, I mean, that gets a laugh out of me for sure. But at the same time, you know, that is another pretty, that is a sad, sad reality. And
it's,
you get the feeling that a lot of people would truly react like that to somebody offering, you know, something so ultimately trivial to them. But I thought that was a moment in this movie that works very well, in addition to kind of being a killer punchline.
His, you know, performance in that scene, and I'm not talking about the actor, I'm talking about Mikey's performance, like, at the counter. You know, he's behind them. Every time they say they're thinking about something, he's like, you get whatever you want. And then he would go to the cashier. They're getting whatever they want, anything you want. Get the small, get the large, get the large, get whatever you want. It's on me, get the large. You already are just so aware that this guy is bad news. You know, smarminess throughout this whole thing. You could just, it really, like, plays slime ball perfectly. It makes you uncomfortable watching him do this. Wishing that the circumstances for these two ladies was better so that they wouldn't have to deal with this guy.
This is sort of where the movie takes a huge turn, because this is our introduction to Rayleigh, or also known as Strawberry, the 17-year-old employee who Mikey lusts over, grooms, manipulates over the course of the rest of the film.
His daughter.
This is who Brody thought was his daughter.
I also thought the reason he was desperate to get out of there when they were in there was because he was like, oh my god, that's my daughter.
Oh.
Like, we need to leave. Like, I didn't realize what was going on. And then he has that conversation with Lonnie right after you meet her where he's like, she is legal as an eagle. I was like, wait, like, hold on.
Oh, brother. Yeah, that's not a great realization to have. The Mikey-Strawberry relationship is really the center of the movie. In a way, it's what all of this chaos was leading up to. Because in these scenes with the two of them, when we're in her company, almost seeing him, not from her point of view, but from her vantage point, I think, you know, she so clearly sees this character differently than the audience sees him. To us, you know, he is so clearly manipulating her and tricking her into seeing him as this fun and friendly guy who she can trust.
And rich.
Ridiculous as that seems to
us, like a big out of towner who's, you know, back and
can change her life. Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, you grow up in a place like this, I mean, that sounds so appealing to you. As insane as it seems to the audience, like, I don't think that it's too much of a stretch to see why a girl that young, like, in a place like this, somebody so impressionable, you know, might react positively to that kind of attention.
Right.
And like you said, it helps that he lies to her about who he is, and especially where he lives, having her drop him off every night in this rich suburb before walking home to the barren plot of land where he actually lives. The scenes where the two of them are together are some of the most uncomfortable in the movie, and, like, not just for the obvious reasons. There's this moment where Mikey sees Strawberry kissing a boy her own age, like she should be doing by all accounts, and he, like, freaks out and not only demands that she break things off with this other kid, Nash, makes a point of debasing and humiliating this kid who's, like, half his age by...
It's like 17.
Yeah, by driving up to this kid's house, pulling him aside, telling Strawberry to break up with him, and then telling Nash to look up his, Mikey's, porn career on the internet. That is the scene that I find the most hard to watch, I think, but it does lead to the funniest scene in the movie, which is when Nash brings his parents to the donut shop in the big pickup truck, and they collectively beat Mikey's ass in one of the more deserved acts of redemption I've seen in a long time. But also just
Nash
this.
Also just chills with his sunglasses on and is like, yo, what the fuck? Like, yeah, honestly, Nash, you're right. Like, this is crazy.
Nash is right. What the fuck?
Nash is right. Like, this is nuts.
Oh, my God.
Like, I mean, the dad is like, you know, who are you? Like, what are you doing? Old porn star hitting on 17-year-old. Don't. He's right. Get out of here.
from this point on, the plot of the movie essentially is Mikey trying to get Strawberry to become a porn star, like basically the second she turns 18, to come with him to go to LA to create this career in the porn industry because he thinks that she's going to be this like can't miss ringer type, like unbelievable once in a lifetime type porn star, basically the fucking Wemby of porn.
But the reason it has nothing to do for her is because he wants to be able to ride that and make money off of her.
Oh, exactly. And, like, basically, he doesn't care about her career, he cares about his.
Yeah, he's trying to pimp her out. 17-year-old girl who had a nice boyfriend named Nash, really kind of got the short end of the stick in this movie.
Yeah, and so kind of as this progress plays out, you know, we have more realizations about Mikey himself, but, you know, we learn more about Strawberry, more about Lexi and Lil, you know, a lot of things that really are quite haunting, and I think stick with you long after you watch the movie. You know, it's things like that Craigslist conversation that Mikey and Lil have around the like halfway point of the film, where it's becomes like incredibly real, and like you realize that while Sean Baker's creating these characters that bring comedy with their, you know, presence to the scene, at the same time, these characters are also real people, and like he treats them with the nuance, the emotional weight that deserves. And, you know, if there's this particularly ugly part of these people's lives, and something that, you know, so many people, so many real people in the real world have to do, he doesn't shy away from, well, not quite portraying that on screen, but at least giving that its worth in keying the audience in on just how emotionally and physically devastating something like that can be. So really throughout the like second half of the movie, it all sort of comes into focus, and the reality of the situation for these people, I think, becomes a lot more human. I'm curious how you feel about how a lot of this plays out.
I think the scene that hit the hardest is when she's asking him to come to the custody hearing with the, you know, about her son, I am assuming. And it's coming after a few scenes where, like, beforehand, like, Mikey initiates first, like, starting a relationship back up with her. And he says it'll be like we're still married. And then she goes, we are still married. And it's like, okay, well, that's not great. So it's, you know, like already, like he ran out on his wife. And then the more time you spend around him talking about her, it's just like that obviously means nothing to him. Like she then starts to believe that maybe because he's starting to pay for rent, he's like making some money. Like they're actually like they're sort of having like a normal relationship almost for a little bit. And then obviously that's right when he meets Strawberry and things change, you know, and not like you as the viewer know, like that's never going to happen. But like you also sort of feel for her because you can tell she's starting to believe that this is possible. And like
she has no other choice.
She's no choice because he's, you know, bringing in money. They have nothing, you know. And Lil, the mother, asks him, like, hey, can't have her hurt again. Can't do that. Just like I can't take it. That's the, you know, the selling your body on the street again. So you have to be in. And if you're in, I welcome you back. Like you are, you know, and like she's been screaming at him and yelling at him the whole movie. So for her to say, like, you know, I welcome you back in with open arms. But if you're out, then get out. And he obviously says, like, I'm in because he's not leaving. It's just depressing. It's like it's a rough situation that, you know, is not good. You just feel for her, like for Lexi in this situation, because it's just so awful and it's not getting any better. And you know that he's not making it better and he's making it so much worse. It all kind of comes to a head at that custody hearing, like when, or not at the custody hearing, when she asks to go with him because she like feels like she could end up having a life. And then he just completely throws a hammer through whatever window she thought was there and shatters the whole dream. So it's really rough. And then that also kind of harkens back to earlier on in the movie when he says something about two people who moved out to the middle of nowhere with a kid and have like a, you know, quote unquote, like boring ass life or something. It's like, well, that's kind of all they want here. And he's like actively destroying whatever chances they have at that. It's really kind of just a bummer. It's well written because you really kind of feel it.
Before we get into the, like the very end of the movie, let's talk about NSYNC, huh?
Yeah, why are they everywhere throughout this movie?
He uses Bye 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 over and over in the movie, plays over the opening credits that show Mikey on the bus coming back to town.
That was
really
fun.
I love the opening sequence. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Crucially, it is the song that Strawberry sings toward the end of the movie when Mikey is trying to snatch her from this town and from her family and friends so that she can become the world's greatest porn star. And it's only when we hear her sing that song that we realize that she's really fucking talented. And
right.
that she has what it takes to make it out of rural Texas on her own and have her own musical career, if that's what she chooses. And the stakes become so much greater when we realize what's at play here. And as obvious as it is throughout the entire movie that Mikey is poison and the worst influence imaginable on such a young girl, I think it's after that scene where we hear her sing that the plan he devised loses its feel of inevitability. I think Sean Baker does a really great job of constructing this film in a way that feels like it's on autopilot for most of its runtime and like it has no control over its own protagonist, as we're stuck watching him take advantage of his wife and her mother and exploit this poor kid he's neighbors with and taunt the 17-year-old kid whose girlfriend he's grooming to be a porn star and lie to everybody in his life. And it's not until we hear Rayleigh sing and have that recognition of what she'll lose and what she'll be sacrificing in order to make what will certainly be the worst decision of her life that Baker takes control of the steering wheel and veers Mikey into a truck, figuratively and literally. Because after that, we go into the car crash. And that is where the plot of the movie really comes to a head.
It's interesting that, you know, I feel like I haven't even mentioned this whole time what he's doing to Lonnie. And part of what we were talking about earlier with him doing the stolen valor thing at the mall, forgot to mention that when he gets in the car, Mikey berates him for lying and like trying to get away with something like that, because he's like, well, I have to be seen with you and like all these things. Just a complete lack of awareness on his end, I guess. Like, you feel like he should be proud of him for trying to pull that off just based on what you know about him, but obviously that's not the way he thinks.
Mikey and Lonnie driving back from one of their escapades. They quickly approach an exit. Mikey veers the steering wheel or tells Lonnie to do so. It's not entirely 100% clear exactly how what happens comes to pass. And we don't even actually see it in real time. We get a very quick cut to them returning.
Filmy.
And then we see on the news that night the aftermath of this 20-car pileup that was caused by the two of them. Yeah. No one killed, luckily, but caused by this tractor trailer that they caused to crash and then fled the crime scene. So Mikey does not end up taking the fall for this. Lonnie is the one who is caught, and he doesn't rat Mikey out. And again, there's sort of that feel of like, you know, it's obviously Mikey's fault what happened, but since he didn't like actually
he wasn't the one driving,
there is sort of that like
plausible deniability.
Yeah, but at this point, I mean, it really feels like everything has gone off the rails for Mikey. I mean, he is at this point forever altering the lives of everyone around him, basically just throwing them into
Lonnie
as much chaos as he
is. He's trying
to
ruin this 17-year-old. He's like ruining these people's lives that he's like forcing himself on, like to live with. Like, it's just, it's a mess.
And this is around the time that he says to Lexi, thanks for letting me stay here. It's been great. I've had a good month, but I'm leaving. So goodbye. And she basically says nothing during this whole speech. You know, we can gauge her reaction. We can sense sort of how she wants to react to this realization. Because at this point, I mean, we know, the audience knows that this means it's more or less over for her. and that she's going to have to go back to a very dark place. And the implications for her are much worse than maybe Mikey even knows, but certainly that he's letting on in this discussion. And then that
wouldn't care even if he did know.
He would not care if he did know. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then that leads us into the climax of the movie, which in my eyes also serves as a bit of an appetizer for Honora, because this last scene in which June and a number of her siblings or cousins, I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is. Yeah, these people have Lexi rats on Mikey to them, and they show up in his bedroom when he's sleeping and they rob him while he's naked. And the yelling and the chaos and the back and forth and the laughter at each other and the just sort of slapstick feel to that scene, that is a lot of what you find in Honora, especially, you know, once the Three Stooges, if you will, in that movie show up. And so, like, clearly creating scenes like that that have that very specific sort of Safdie Brothers energy, clearly a drawing skill of Sean Baker's. And, you know, for as great of a, like, I don't know if I want to say populist, but as a filmmaker who really makes a point of exposing some of the underseen corners of society to movie-going audiences, you know, he's also very good at crafting an entertaining movie around a very brash, entertaining protagonist. I think this is probably Sean Baker's strongest film to date.
I believe it. I kind of, while I was watching this movie, I sort of felt like Glenn Howerton could have done this role really well. Maybe it's just because Dennis Reynolds is a similar kind of psychopath manipulator type role. You kind of can't take your eyes off him. He's like a walking car crash. Like, everything he touches, he just, like, you have to stare at it. And, like, you just can't. You want to know what he's going to do next, because he's a wrecking ball. Like, you know, I also, like, there's the scene after he realizes that Lonnie is not going to rat him out because his lawyer reads a statement on TV. Mikey runs into the backyard and is, like, pumping his fist and running around dancing and yelling and celebrating. And he catches his eye of Lonnie's father in the backyard, who just stares at him. Lonnie's father is interesting because he doesn't say a word this entire movie, but he's just going through the motions. You kind of expect him to say something there, him just looking at him and just kind of knowing that, what is he going to say? What's he going to do? Like, he can't do anything to him. Like, he knows that it's probably Mikey's fault, but what's he going to do? Like, you know, Mikey cannot be stopped. Like, everything he tries to get away with, he does. It kind of is just a good way to sum up this whole movie, which is anybody who can actually see him for what he is going to respond to him like that. They're just going to stare at him disapprovingly, hope that he doesn't further destroy anything. The closer he gets to somebody, the more likely it is that they're going to end up in trouble. And then it is a nice comeuppance at the end to see him, you know, much like Lonnie says at the beginning of the movie, run out of the bedroom naked. You know, he has to run across town and he goes to Strawberry's door and imagines her coming out in a bikini, which what did you make of that?
That was going to be my last question for you, actually, was okay. What we make of the ending. I'm glad we are asking each other this. So, yeah, you know, like you say, Mikey has to rock out with his cock out for a while.
Very well said.
Goes across town. And yeah, I mean, this is definitely presented with a lot of ambiguity as to how much of this is, like, actually happening. For me, there is no world in which the vision he has of her coming outside in the bikini and, like, ready to go with him to California is actually happening or is going to happen to him at any point. Okay, I'm glad we're in agreement on that. I imagine most people are, but you never know. I have some doubts as to whether or not he even makes it to her house. Like, I sort of don't think he's going to be able to walk all the way there without being stopped. Like, I think that, I mean, how far away is that? Like, that's a couple towns away. Like, she drives her car pretty far. So if he's actually walking there, I mean, you know, maybe to genuinely have that much freedom in that part of the world where you can just go ass naked and end up all the way on the other side of town. But it's very possible that his story ends knocking at her door, pleading for this underage girl to come with him to be a porn star to LA while he is standing there with no clothes, no money, no car, no plan at this point, because everything that he was planning to do has been shot to shit. Hey, you're right. He has $200. He might be able to get him to, like, the next town over.
Tucson.
Or maybe he can buy Lexi and Lil some more donuts with that money. There is no way this movie ends with her enthusiastically coming out to meet him. That dream is dead.
Is it then, because why include her dancing in the door? Is it just to show what he... Like, he's out of his mind? Like, he thinks this is still possible? Or is it that he's, like, you know...
I think it's a desperate fantasy from a pathetic man whose goose has finally been cooked. At the same time, you know, I could see Sean Baker intending this as just sort of a hiccup for him. And, like, while it's probably over for him and Strawberry, you know, this sort of character would be so... resilient, where he might just try this again in, like, another town with some other girl who's turning 18 the year after. You know, it's that creepy ass McConaughey character's line from Dazed and Confused. You know, he gets older, they stay the same 18. Age.
It's interesting that this movie does not, like, yes, he gets his comeuppance and it's like he has to walk out and he gets told to shut up and, like, the whole thing. Walks out silently, just flipping him off or whatever. It's like, that's nice. It's like, it feels good for a second, but you're right. Like, there's, it, like, when we first meet him, arguably, he's in worse shape because he has no money. So, you know, now he has $200. He actually kind of ends this movie up compared to where he starts off.
I don't know about that. I think he is in the same position, just with no clothes this time.
Maybe that's fair. It could be like a, you know, it's comparable, I think. I mean, he just got the shit kicked out of him at the beginning of the movie. So what hand would you rather be dealt? At least this time he has money and, you know, maybe not clothes, but he could just go get some and then he'll get himself a bus ticket. He'll probably just move on. You can go to Galveston right across the bridge down there. Like, it's depressing that this character is like, you know that he's like just going to be fine, you know, and do this again somewhere else. And like, yes, he's at a loss at the end, but you just kind of know, not going to last.
I'd like to see old Mikey Saber wriggle his way out of this jam.
Mikey Saber easily wriggles his way out of said jam. Ah, well, nevertheless.
Shit, maybe he is an allegory for Trump.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think early on, that was also part of why I thought it was his daughter, by the way. but I did kind of see him as this blustering, because that's the first time you're introduced to him. That's what he's doing. He's just yelling the turned backs of Lexi and Lil, who are just sitting there smoking, trying to ignore him as best they can, and kind of hoping he'll go away. inserts himself under their skin more and more. Yeah, it's he's a really good character. Like, he feels extremely loathsome, but you understand, you know, how this guy exists and how he's able to succeed and do what he does, especially to these poor people who don't deserve this.
Yeah, I think the main sort of difference between this movie and Anora for me is Anora is a character who a lot of things happen to, you know, this Russian billionaire's son sort of comes into her strip club and offers her a bunch of money to pretend to be his girlfriend and then ends up proposing to her and then has the people in this kid's life come about and throw her whole life into disarray. So, you know, she's never really in control of her environment or the things that are happening to her. Whereas Mikey Saber is the total opposite. He is the driver. Right. He is the force behind everything that happens in this movie. You get the sense that the characters in this movie just sort of have things happen to them are like Lexi and Lil and Lonnie and a lot of the people who Mikey shows up and, you know, either completely wrecks their lives or almost does. So, yeah, I think that's the main difference, is that he is this manipulator, this go-getter in a sense, but shit, not in a good way at all. I mean, just this guy who, you summed it up perfectly, Brody, he's a wrecking ball. I think this is, like I said, Sean Baker's best movie to date. It is definitely the one I get the most enjoyment out of when watching. I mean, perhaps an Anora rewatch will change that, you know, whenever I get around to that. But I am very impressed with his career trajectory. He is one of a handful of American directors under the age of like 55 that I would actively go out and watch whatever they make right now.
I'm definitely intrigued. I will probably be watching Anora at some point soon because I like the way that he tells the story. again, like, when you focus on people who are not, I mean, I don't want to say, like, the underbelly of the country, but that is what they are. You know, like, it's just, it's an ignored part of the population. These really impoverished people in really kind of industrial, not much going on areas, you know. It's intriguing because, like, you know, you have a lot of preconceived notions about the people who live there, about the, like, what is going on, like, what the problems are and why, and, like, all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, people are just trying to get by anywhere you go, and, you know, no matter what it is. And when you have someone like Mikey who is able to exploit the situation, like, that is part of, I think, why he's a good, you know, allegory for Trump, and why that specter is present here. It's just because it's like a, it's like a parasite that's feeding off of, like, the circumstances that have led to this awful situation for these people, and just this difficult way of life. It would take so much to make things better. He's a result of the outer lying problems. Like, he's not the problem. You know what I mean? Makes for a fun character.
Absolutely. Well, we should probably wrap it up here. We are encroaching on 2 hours for this episode, so I am very glad that we got to go so in-depth on this movie. I think it is a very rich text. So much to discuss, so many wonderful performances by a lot of performers that I have never seen in any movie before, because this is their only acting credit. So
yep.
Whenever you come across a movie like that, I mean, I think that is pretty special. You know, the fact that
I think Lil was a waitress.
I also saw that the woman who played Lil passed away shortly after the release of this movie, so rest in peace. Yeah, very sad. Red Rocket, not much else to say. Fantastic movie, holds up, is going to hold up for a while. If you have not seen it, highly recommend. That goes for any of the last 4, I believe, Sean Baker films. I have not seen any of his work prior to Tangerine, I will admit, so I cannot in good conscience recommend something I haven't seen. But Florida Project, Red Rocket, Anora, all fantastic movies. Can't recommend them enough. If you're listening, you've probably seen them, but if not, hey, get on that shit. And if you haven't already signed up for the Mudville Patreon, get on that shit too. You can find it at patreon.com/mudville. Subscribe to the show. You can throw us a few dollars in support, or just sign up for free and receive updates anytime we release new content, whether that be an episode of the main feed or one of the Mudville at the Movies episodes, including the one that I just put out earlier this week with Tony Brown on Matt Farley's film Local Legends Bloodbath. So a lot of great movie content coming to you guys this week from us here at Mudville. That's going to do it for us this week. I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I've been your other host, Brody Staub.
And we will see you guys next week. Happy Thanksgiving.
See you next week. Happy Thanksgiving. For you, just another player in your game for two. You may hate me, but it ain't no lie. Baby, bye, bye, bye. Don't really want to make it tough. I just want to tell you that I've had enough. Might sound crazy, but it ain't no lie. Bye, bye, bye. Just hit me with the truth now. Boy, you're more than welcome to. So give me one good reason, baby, come on. I've lived for you and me, and now I've really come to see that life would be much better. Bye, bye, bye. You may hate me, but it ain't no lie. Baby, bye, bye, bye.